And towards the end of the day on Saturday, we were talking about why it is that we continue to go to church and how it is that we're resolving issues, that we're questioning issues of faith. And she read a statement that she had delivered in a testimony meeting in her ward. And I thought it was such a beautiful combination of faith and reason, so well thought out, I found it very inspirational. And I remember talking about it to my husband and saying, that's a woman who's a real role model for me. So I appreciated hearing that and appreciate the opportunity, the privilege of being able to chair this session today. My name is Rebecca Pyatt Davidson. It says Platt in your program, but it's Pyatt. Nadine, who is our speaker, is a practicing lawyer in the Bay Area. She's been in practice since 1986. She's a writer for Sunstone. She's married and has four children. She holds degrees from San Jose State and the University of Santa Clara. And she'll be delivering our address. Armin Moss is the respondent. He is coming out with a book in a couple of weeks from the University of Illinois Press entitled The Angel and the Beehive. So you can ask him about that. He says it's a study of retrenchment process in the church for the past generation. So that'll be something interesting for you to question him about. Let's go ahead and get started. Thanks.
Thank you. When I was young and growing up in the church, someone along the way told me that Mormons believe everything that is true, that all truth is part of Mormonism. I took that platitude to heart and grew up valuing the quest for truth and thinking that all the truth I could ever learn would somehow fit into my Mormon worldview. In the past 20 years or so, the quest for truth seems to have ground to a halt, replaced by dedication to a consistent story, whether or not that story happens also to be true. Our church curriculum materials are designed to reassure the faithful at all costs that those in charge are always right. All scriptures and quotations from Latter-day prophets are carefully selected by the nameless authors of our duly constituted lesson materials with that end in mind. This institutional preoccupation with consistency and authority has heightened our pre-existing fundamentalist tendencies. Meanwhile, a fixation on avoiding all controversy by systematically excluding inconvenient facts has given us lesson materials that are not only fundamentalist, but also fundamentally boring. Episcopal Bishop John Shelby Spong, writing of a parallel trend among the larger American Christian community, could just as well have had Mormon classes in mind when he wrote, "I am not impressed by what passes for adult education in most churches. Many a church adult Bible class is little more than the pooling of ignorance." In our church, the pooling of ignorance has been aided and abetted by nearly 25 years of Correlation, the program designed to simplify and standardize all Mormon thought. Lest any teacher should think of supplementing the meager fare offered us in our lesson manuals, announcements in the church news periodically remind teachers to teach for their entire class periods using the approved materials. We are supposed to enjoy this fare, find it uplifting, inspiring, and spiritually nourishing. Elder Ballard, speaking last fall to the Relief Society annual meeting, offered three suggestions for keeping our eternal perspective clear and unimpaired, the first of which was, quote, "Focus on fundamentals. With so much depth and substance in the simple truths of the gospel, you need never to wade in the shallow waters of speculative theology." At least I know he listens to Paul Toscano. That's Paul's phrase. "Teach one another in Relief Society and in your visiting teaching the pure doctrines found in the scriptures and in the approved curriculum." One of the ironies of the present pooling of ignorance within Mormonism is that it has reached its height at a time when more information is within the reach of more Mormons than at any time in the history of the church. Those who read Sunstone, Dialogue, Mormon Women's Forum, and the veritable flood of other journals and books geared toward the Mormon market know more about church history, theological and ideological development, and sociological trends over time than Mormons have ever known before. We cannot continue as a church to ignore this information. We need to acknowledge it and integrate it into our faith story. If we do not, our faith loses its integrity, and our church loses its credibility. Over the past decade, my own response to the dumbing down of the church curriculum has ranged from resignation to despair at what I consider to be a case of terminal boredom. Occasionally, though, it has emerged as levity. One Sunday a few years ago, while sitting through a particularly dull meeting, hearing again what I've known since primary, the following song for alternate voices composed itself in my mind. with apologies to Eliza, R. Snow, and Paul Toscano. Again, we meet among the board to hear what we have heard before. Our correlated lesson manuals now are all complete, and each 4 years, the lessons will repeat. Help us, O Lord, to stay awake while we endure yet another remake of faith-promoting stories meant to stifle every jot and tittle of each new idea or stimulating thought. Mostly, though, I think this is no laughing matter, so I've formulated a serious response. In so doing, I have assumed that those individuals who are perfectly happy with their church experience and are not present, and indeed would deny the legitimacy of this event and this discussion. I have assumed, too, that those of you who are here wish to remain in the church, and that despite the frustration you feel over its ideological, social, and intellectual rigidity, you find comfort and hope in many of its teachings and enjoy and cherish your sense of community within the church. In short, I have assumed that, like me, you believe some things, hope some things, and endure the rest. Well, I've always expressed my opinions in church. Last fall's disciplinary actions against the church's respected scholars and feminists jarred me into the realization that there is a desperate need for moderates and liberals to speak up for the Mormon middle ground before it erodes right out from under our feet. If we fail to do that, we allow Mormon discourse to be dominated by the most conservative and traditional voices, those most certain of the correctness of their views, those most unwilling to admit the validity of alternative views, those most emphatic and insistent that their views, being the only true ones, are the ones which must prevail and, indeed, are the only ones which should even be spoken. But this is our church, too. If the church is to be a place where we want to be, a place where we want our children to be, we must speak up. We must speak up for our own spiritual and emotional well-being so that we don't have to worship in a spiritual and emotional wasteland. The growing authoritarian, anti-intellectual, anti-feminist environment does not nurture my spirituality, and it does not teach my children what they need to know and understand in order to live a spiritual life in our modern world. We must speak up because for every one of us who comes to the Sunstone Symposium, there are dozens of people sitting in our wards who are starving along with us. Many of them don't know why they are unsatisfied with their church experience, but they know that their needs are not being met. From my own experience in speaking up, I can assure you that when you do it, people who rarely say a word in church classes will quietly tell you how appreciative they are of your comments. Like you, they are craving some substance, some fresh air. They would like to find a way to connect with the divine in their church experience, and they will rarely find it in an institutional setting that increasingly values unquestioning obedience over the thoughtful pursuit of spiritual insight. The need for and responsiveness to more moderate voices is reflected in the ringing success of Chieko Okazaki's books and tapes. She has been a solid and consistent voice for the Mormon middle ground of encouraging diversity and of accepting one another as we are rather than trying to squeeze everyone into the same mold. Her first book, Lighten Up, quickly became a bestseller for Deseret Book. Cat's Cradle did the same for Bookcraft. I applaud and admire her candor in being a moderate voice and speaking up to a much larger audience than any of us will ever reach. I recommend her books as source material for speaking up for the middle ground, especially in Relief Society. We must speak up because if we allow conservatives to dominate all discourse, we conspire in fostering the false impression that conservatives own all spirituality. This creates a real and present danger to those of us who have the integrity to try to unite faith and reason. If we allow ourselves to be marginalized by unchecked conservative discourse, we allow the church to become an increasingly intolerant place. We must speak up in self-defense, or last fall's spectacle of the excommunication of scholars will be repeated. This is less likely to occur if those who speak with more moderate and liberal voices can also be identified as models of spirituality with their own valid ways of being Mormon. Finally, we must speak up because if we leave all the speaking to fundamentalists, we will eventually have a church with a worldview so far removed from people's lives that it will no longer be a viable religion. Episcopal Bishop John Shelby Spong, in his book Rescuing the Bible from Fundamentalists, has described this problem in the broader American context. Spong writes of the tension between science and religion, but his words apply as well to the tension between scholarship and religion, feminism and religion, all kinds of modernism and religion. This tension, writes Spong, has increasingly resulted in an anti-intellectual approach to Christianity on the part of the literal-minded. Conservative Christians... This tension has increasingly resulted in an anti-intellectual approach to Christianity on the part of literal-minded conservative Christians and a departure from the organized Christian church into the secular city by scores of modern men and women for whom the mythological framework of the Christian story no longer has any translatable meaning. Above all, it has placed the Bible in jeopardy. If the only people who talk about the Bible are fundamentalists, then fewer and fewer people are going to take seriously a book or a church that appears to them to be so antiquated. That's the end of the quotation by Spong. I hope that by now I've convinced you that you need to speak up, not just here, but back in your wards as well. Now, with a passing allusion to this year's Old Testament course of study, I will offer you my 10 suggestions, I don't do commandments, for how to do it, followed by some examples of my own attempts to practice what I preach. Number one, you shall clarify in your own mind the ideas that are important to your own religious philosophy and spirituality. Coming up with some sort of cohesive way of ordering your own spiritual life and viewpoint will help you evaluate and respond to what you hear at church. It will provide you with some useful standards for separating the wheat from the chaff. It will help you identify what constitutes Mormon middle ground and will help you articulate your own unique contribution to it. In formulating my own religious philosophy, I've decided that whatever faith I hold, my faith must be informed by reason. I'm willing to give God and the church the benefit of my doubts, even make a leap of faith in areas of uncertainty, but I cannot sacrifice reason on the altar of faith. To do so would be to abandon altogether my integrity and to render my faith meaningless for all practical purposes. Two, you shall decide what is important enough to speak up about. Sometimes I hear things at church that are mistaken, even silly, but they're harmless. I usually let such statements pass without challenge since they don't matter and aren't worth arguing about. Other times, I hear things that I consider important, but commenting on them would be more trouble than it's worth. Let me give you an example of the latter. I have a fairly good understanding of the documentary hypothesis, which is the prevailing theory about who wrote the Old Testament and why. The theory postulates that the historic portions of the Old Testament were written by four writers or schools of writers between the years of 900 BCE and 600 BCE and were finalized into their present form in about 400 BCE. I find this theory enlightening and enriching to my understanding of the Old Testament, but I don't think it's very important that I explain it to my ward members. It's too complex to explain in a soundbite as a comment in gospel doctrine class, and alluding to it without explaining it would accomplish nothing and would merely antagonize. I hope that someday the approved materials will introduce Mormons to this theory, but for now there are more fruitful areas for a Mormon dialectic. I find it more productive to speak up for the middle ground in areas where I have a chance of also finding common ground. Number three, you shall educate yourself about the ideas worth speaking up about. With all the material available, it's pretty easy to be a comparative expert on the topics that are important to you. One of my friends in another ward was recently invited to return to gospel doctrine class after a substantial hiatus because the teacher told her that she makes the most profound comments of anyone there. Together, we decided it is very easy to be profound in Sunday school. Four, you shall speak about your faith. This suggestion is a very important one. Mormons have developed a style of speaking about their faith in a way that is intimidating to those who do not have all the answers to life's important questions. If the only acceptable way to express faith is to recite the litany of I know statements that we often hear, then only those who know the approved list of Mormon beliefs will speak about their faith. I think that is one reason why we tend to hear from many of the same people over and over in testimony meetings and rarely hear from most ward members. While I appreciate the faith of those who know, I would also like to hear on occasion from those who are a little less certain. My private conversations with people who rarely speak about their faith has convinced me that they often have rich, deeply held, inspiring beliefs that everyone could benefit from. They just don't say so, either because they lack certainty about their beliefs or because they don't consider their beliefs to be acceptable for expression in Mormon meetings. But the standard formula is not the only way to express faith. If more of us would say what is in our hearts, in our own way, the entire tone of our meetings would change. 5. You shall think about the way you say things. Sometimes the difference between having your views accepted and having them rejected has nothing to do with substance and everything to do with form. Listen to Rush Limbaugh occasionally to hear what a truly offensive person sounds like. And think about whether you sound to your ward members the way he sounds to you. If so, adjust your style. Sometimes adjusting your style is as easy as your choice of words. For example, I know that when scholars speak of myths, they are often referring to the common body of beliefs that speak to our understanding of our world and the way our lives are ordered. Myths could be true stories, or they could be fables, so long as they embody our cultural ideals. But I also know that if I speak of scriptural stories as myths, I will be understood to be denying the authenticity of the stories, an understanding which I may or may not intend. So I've decided to speak of stories rather than myths, just so that I don't allow my language to overshadow my substance. Also, since stories may be true or made-up stories, and people understand that, I can use them to illustrate a point without implying anything about whether I view them as factually correct. For example, I can say, the story of the fall describes our state of alienation from God, without getting into a controversy over whether I consider the fall to be an actual historical event. 6. You shall take the opportunity to say positive things about the topics you speak up on. Lori Winder Stromberg taught me one way to do this when she suggested seizing the high ground by starting out with the words, "One of the things I like most about Mormonism is." There are lots of things we all like about Mormonism. I like its tenet that the glory of God is intelligence. I like its teaching that we must seek wisdom by study as well as by faith. I like its positive view of the essential nature of human beings as children of divine parents, both because it tells of humanity's basic goodness and also of our universal connection as children of the same God. All these and many other precepts fit easily into statements that will broaden and legitimize the Mormon middle ground. 7. You shall remember that you are not alone. You will lose some of your fear about speaking up if you realize that others share your perspectives, even if they don't say so. I used to censor myself at times for fear of offending, for fear of being marginalized, or for fear of being censured for upsetting the new convert in class. What I've learned, however, is that there are many people in my ward who share my views and who love it when I suggest an alternative interpretation. People like to think that they think for themselves, and many people actually do it. They also like to learn new things, and they like to think about the scriptures and about spirituality in ways that they didn't consider before. They will find validation, liberation, and community when you speak up. They will miss your remarks when you're not there, when you don't say anything. Many times, I've been asked if I believed what was being said, and if not, why I let it pass without a challenge. 8. You shall not be intimidated by those trying to silence you by condemning contention. Offering an alternative interpretation of a scripture or pointing out facts not generally known is not being contentious. It is providing the information that we all need to develop informed opinions and ideas and to revise our opinions if we are mistaken. Anyone who tries to silence discussion by condemning contention tacitly admits that he or she has no reasonable response to what you are saying and must resort to spiritual rank pulling. It is an admission that you are right. In those circumstances, hold your ground. 9. You shall lower the emotional stakes of debate by recognizing that most of what passes for doctrine is no such thing. Following the disciplinary actions last fall, the First Presidency and Council of the Twelve issued a joint statement on the actions, justifying them by defending their responsibility to, quote, preserve the doctrinal purity of the Church, close quote. This was a curious justification because, for the most part, those who were disciplined had said little or nothing about doctrine. But since this seems to be an up-and-coming justification for silencing voices that do not speak the party line, it is vital for Mormons to know just what Mormon scriptures say about what constitutes doctrine. In Doctrine and Covenants, section 10, 67 through 68, the Lord is quoted as saying, "Behold, this is my doctrine. Whosoever repenteth and cometh unto me, the same is my church. Whosoever declareth more or less than this, The same is not of me, but is against me. Therefore, he is not of my church. Close quote. By this definition, most of what passes for doctrine isn't. If we can lower the stakes of our discussions by agreeing that doctrine begins and ends with repenting and coming to Christ, people will have much less to fear from rigorous debate. There's a similar passage in 3 Nephi. It's long, and so I didn't put it in, but it says, whosoever saith more than this, more or less than this, and establish it as doctrine, cometh of evil. 10. You shall be prepared. Plan ahead. Prepare for a discussion by reading the materials before you go to your meetings. Read the assigned scriptures. Read them from a good study edition of a modern translation of the Bible, and read the footnotes. You'll have a wealth of information that no one else in class will know about. People will think your comments are profound. Read your Relief Society of Priesthood meeting lessons in advance. Read the study guide questions. I have a postcard that says, I always know the right thing to say after the right time to say it has passed. This happens to me all the time, but it happens less when I think in advance about the topic of discussion and think about some alternative approaches to it. Think about ways to contribute to the discussion that do not support authoritarian, anti-intellectual, anti-feminist ideas. Now I would like to give you some examples of how I have spoken up for the middle ground in recent weeks at church, sometimes with mixed success. I will also include some things that I wanted to say but didn't get the opportunity, in the hope that that these examples will stimulate you thinking about how to do this yourself. On the first Sunday of this year, our gospel doctrine teachers introduced the course material and asked why we should study the Old Testament. After several comments from class members, including some affirming that the Old Testament people had the gospel just like we do, a highly questionable proposition in my view, I raised my hand. When called on, I said, I like the Old Testament because it tells us the story of who we are and how we came to be who we are and how we came to believe what we believe. It provides an important basis for all of Western thought and for our laws and our moral standards and ideals. By my response, I establish myself as a friend to this foundational document that has so greatly influenced not only our religion but our entire society. I did so without saying or even implying that I assume it all to be literal history. The fact is that I do value the Old Testament, although I know that what I get from it is something very different from what many of my class members glean from its pages. I see the Old Testament as a saga of a people struggling to develop and preserve an identity within the context of its sacred story of God's intervention in creating and preserving Israel as a people. In the course of developing that story, the Jews gave to the Western world the concept of ethical monotheism, the belief in one God who cares about how we treat one another and about how we order our society to care for the poor and the oppressed. My comments to my Sunday school class didn't explain all of this, but I hope to revisit this topic in the weeks to come. The second week in Sunday school, the teacher showed us a videotape about the creation of the world. It showed scenes of space and earth, of plants and animals, while the narrator read the first chapter of Genesis. After the video, the teacher solicited comments on the Mormon understanding of creation. Someone pointed out that God declared creation good at each stage along the way, and then after the creation of man, declared it to be very good. Most comments, however, centered on the idea that because of modern-day revelation, we know a lot more about the creation than the rest of the world. Overall, they took a very literalistic view of the scriptural creation accounts. I was uncomfortable with literalism expressed in the comments, so I said, the creation story in Genesis 1 is my favorite creation story. I have read... It is. I have read creation myths from many different cultures, and this is the story I like best. I like the fact that, as someone already said, God declared each stage of creation good, and after creating humanity, male and female, in the image of God, declared it very good. I also like this account because of all the creation stories I've ever read, it is the only one that describes creation in a way that generally coincides with what scientists tell us about the evolution of life on our planet, as life evolved from simpler to more complex life forms. After the world is created, the earth brings forth plants, and then the waters bring forth sea life. Then the earth brings forth more complex animals, and finally human beings. While I don't think this story was ever intended to be a scientific treatise on how life came to exist on this planet, I find it to be a rather remarkable story. This comment met with mixed success. The teacher suggested that I read the discussion in the Institute manual so that I would understand that my interpretation might not be correct. But another class member surprised me by telling the class that he was thinking along the same lines I was. The next week, we discussed the fall. I sat out most of the discussion because several others in the class were doing a fine job of carrying the dialogue along in ways that suggested symbolic meaning for the fall. If I had said anything, it would probably have been that I like Carl Sagan's exegesis on Eden as a metaphor for the development of human intelligence and the capacity for moral reasoning. In other words, for the development of knowledge of good and evil. But in this case, I waited until near the end of class and said, I think the discussion we've had here today shows that there is more than one way to understand the creation and the fall, and that many of us here have differing views. I hope there is room for all our viewpoints, and that we don't have to say that there is just one right way to understand these scriptures. I also pointed out that the New Encyclopedia of Mormonism does not take a hardline anti-evolution viewpoint. The lesson about Abraham, which was a week or two later, was a gold mine of things to talk about. I would have enjoyed teaching it. It contained the account of Abraham lying about Sarah being his sister, the story of God's covenant with Abraham, and the story of Abraham's attempted sacrifice of Isaac. In general, I despise the way these stories are treated in the curriculum materials. In the Institute Manual, which is being widely read in connection with the Old Testament, Abraham's lying is justified because the Book of Abraham says that the Lord told him to do it. This may be the first recorded instance of lying for the Lord. The manual quotes Joseph Smith as saying that whatever God commands is right because, quote, what is wrong under one circumstance may be and often is right under another, close quote. This notion has the potential for a mountain of mischief in the name of God. If I had had the chance, I would have pointed out that numerous passages of Scripture say that God hates lying, that truth is part of God's essential nature, and that, in fact, God cannot lie. Furthermore, Mormon scriptures tell us who it is who is the father of lies. I would also have said that it seems more likely to me that Abraham would have lied about what God told him than it seems likely that God would lie or instigate a lie. God's covenant with Abraham, as reported in Genesis 15, is a fascinating account, though it was omitted from this year's reading assignments. In it, God promises the aging, childless Abraham that he will have posterity as numerous as the stars of the sky who will possess the land on which Abraham is living. Abraham asks God how he can be sure that God will fulfill his promises. God then tells Abraham to bring a heifer, a she-goat, a ram, and two birds. Abraham retrieves the animals, cuts them in half, except for the birds, and lays the halves of their carcasses on the ground side by side. At evening, a smoking furnace and a burning lamp symbolizing the presence of God appear and pass between the halves of the carcasses. This ceremony is documented in cuneiform tablets dating from about the time Abraham was supposed to live and describes a means of making a solemn covenant. The parties pass between the severed halves of the animals, symbolizing their vows that if they do not keep up their end of the bargain, the same thing should happen to them that happened to the animals. In this story, however, only God passes between the carcasses, Abraham does not, symbolizing that the covenant is God's unilateral promise to Abraham. One point I would make from this story is that it portrays God using the symbols that were familiar to Abraham's time to speak to Abraham about his promises. I would suggest that it teaches us that God can speak to us through our familiar symbols and rituals in the same way God spoke to Abraham through his. I would also use the story as a lead-in to my explanation of Abraham's attempted sacrifice of Isaac, a story that makes most of us shudder. This story is usually told with accolades for Abraham's faith and with the message to us that we should be willing to sacrifice everything we have to God in total submission and obedience if we are told to do so. It is also taught as a type and shadow of the later sacrifice of Jesus Christ. If I were teaching a class about it, I would probe it for a different meaning. Historically, many Jewish commentators have viewed the story as God's repudiation of human sacrifice. This view finds support in the fact that the Old Testament condemns human sacrifice in about a half dozen places, one of which quotes God as saying, quote, which practice I commanded them not, neither came it into my mind that they should do this abomination. That's in Jeremiah 32:35. Nowhere in the entire Old Testament is this story of Abraham and Isaac ever again mentioned. Moriah. The only other place Mount Moriah is mentioned is in 2 Chronicles, where it says that Solomon began to build his temple to the Lord at that site. It could be argued that the real message of this story is that the Lord who rescued Isaac from being sacrificed was showing that he would have no such abominable practice at the site of his temple. I hope that my comments in this paper will provide you with some ideas about how to speak up for a view of God and a view of our religion that values reason and independent thought, and that does not impose authoritarian, literalistic interpretations on the Scriptures. Such interpretations do not serve us well if they require us to deny our own perceptions of reality and of right and wrong in order to get a faith message from our holy books. I believe that the Mormon middle ground is a place where people can hold diverse views and still share a common faith. But I fear that in our institutional obsession to package the faith into a neat little bundle with no loose ends, we are squeezing all the life out of it. Let me conclude with an Old Testament parable for our time. The writer of Exodus, purportedly Moses, says that the children of Israel murmured against Moses and Aaron in the wilderness. Moses' response to this murmuring was to tell the people, "Your murmurings are not against us, but against the Lord." But maybe the difference between a murmur and a legitimate request is a simple matter of perspective. Maybe the characterization of a request as murmuring is merely the view from the vantage point of those in charge, holding on to their authority to shield themselves from criticism no matter how valid. The Israelites, starving in the desert and unable to find sustenance for themselves and their children, cried out, "Ye have brought us forth into this wilderness to kill this whole assembly with hunger." And the God who knew their need before they asked fed Israel with manna and quail and brought forth water from the solid rock. The psalmist made no mention of murmuring when he praised God's gracious care of Israel, saying, "The people asked, and he brought forth quail and satisfied them with the bread of heaven. He opened the rock, and the waters gushed out. They ran in the dry places like a river, and he brought forth his people with joy and his chosen with gladness." If there is a famine in our land today, a famine of hearing the words of the Lord, if hearing we hear not, and seeing we see not, it is not for want of the words, but for the silencing of voices. The feast, the quail, the bread of heaven, the rushing living waters are in our hands. All we need to do is bring them to the table.
I surely appreciate the wonderful, constructive comments and suggestions that Nadine has made. I think we can all benefit by those, and we really should take them to heart and try them. Nadine, of course, is absolutely right that there has been a change in the church, and it hasn't just happened in the 80s. It's been going on a long time. I hate to admit this, but I came to California to live as a small boy in 1931 and lived in both the Southern California and the Bay Area of California until 25 years ago when we went up to Washington to take another career line. Seemed like a good idea at the time. And considering what's happened to California lately, I guess we're probably better off. During the time that I was growing up and was a young man with a young family in California, there was a different feel to the church, at least in California. And I can remember very clearly when the presiding brethren of the church, as well as local priesthood leaders, believed that the intellectual enterprise, if allowed to flower and bloom, would vindicate Mormonism, not threaten Mormonism. Now, they may have been unduly optimistic about that, but the attitude change is what's remarkable. The attitude change toward the scholarly enterprise. And we really are going through a time right now where I think it is appropriate to use the term that Nadine has used, which is fundamentalism. Now, mostly when Mormons use that, of course, it refers to the polygamy holdouts. But outside of the Mormon setting, fundamentalism refers to a certain kind of mindset or mentality that you find in other Christian groups. And There is a fairly well understood and generally agreed upon definition for that mentality, which I won't undertake to lay out for you now, because I think we probably all have a pretty good feel for what it means. But this scriptural literalism and the resort to or an understanding of scriptures as inerrant, glorification of obedience over intellectual independence, which is not something that was invented in Salt Lake, I can assure you. It's been going on for a long time in lots of other denominations. And the anti-intellectual, anti-science, especially anti-evolutionary approach, these are all things that have been around in other religious denominations for a long time. And there has always been some of this running through Mormonism. There's always been, you know, many ways of looking at things, and an approach that would be recognized in other religions as a fundamentalist approach has always been present in Mormonism to some extent. What's remarkable about the last generation is the waxing of that mentality, both among the leadership and among the grassroots. One of the things that signals this change more than anything else is that if you go back and look at the people who were called to the Quorum of the 12 Apostles in the first third of this century up to about 1930, a third of them were PhD scientists. A third of them. Now, it doesn't mean you have to be a PhD scientist to be important or to be spiritual, but it's the mix that I think is interesting and important. So that whenever there was a fundamentalist abroad in the land calling for shooting down evolutionary theory or anybody who believed in it, there was always a scientist or two who had both spiritual credibility and intellectual credibility who could blow the whistle on that. That's the kind of thing that has been lost. And what we see now is, ironically, not very authentic Mormonism. These expressions we're feeling at church are borrowings from Protestant fundamentalists. That's the irony of it. By the way, the Protestant fundamentalists are the most anti-Mormon people there are. And we're borrowing from the way that they look on scriptural and religious matters. There's a tremendous irony there. Of course, to be fair, I think we have to admit that during the first half of this century, when we were trying so hard as a people to live down the 19th century and become super American, during that time there were equally inauthentic borrowings from the Protestant mainstream, from liberal Protestantism, from the Anglican and Episcopal tradition in particular. So what we're doing now is really not maybe borrowing any more from outside the church, but we're borrowing from different places. And so that's the kind of broader context that I wanted to suggest for perhaps understanding a little better the things that Nadine and I and many of you are feeling in the church. It's this context of a generalized reaction to the success of our own assimilation. We have lived down the 19th century so successfully, and we now look so much like all other Americans, that we have to do something pretty extreme to show how different we are. And so we're resorting to different kinds of extreme efforts to prove, you know, by golly, we are different, you know, take that. You know, I'll do whatever my bishop says, no matter what, top that, you know. Oh, all right, so you got 6 kids, I got 10. Top that, you know. There's this resort to ever greater resort to the most conservative extreme to be able to take a position of really a uniqueness and difference to show how different we are. But the more we emphasize those kinds of differences, the more we look like Nazarenes in Assembly of God and Southern Baptists than like our 19th century spiritual and intellectual forebears. That's the most distressing thing to me. All of this, though, in turn, is part also of an even larger context of going through a generation, starting with the age of Aquarius, in which it seems that not just in our country, but all over the world, ideas and values and standards of conduct that were once unquestionable have all come up for grabs. And in a time like that, not, as I say, I want to emphasize, not just in our country, but in lots of other places of the world, when we go through periods where hallowed and standard and venerable ideas and values are no longer generally accepted and no longer are clear guides to everybody so that we can predict each other's behavior. That's what is important. We have to be able to predict each other's behavior by predicting each other's values. When you can't do that anymore, it gets scary. And so there is a reaction to that process also, a kind of rushing for the most conservative extreme. And this expresses itself in a spread of fundamentalist thinking all over the world. We've read about it all over. It's happening to Islam. It's happening in Israel. It's happening in Christianity, both in the United States and elsewhere. It's a very common development. So all of these things that are making us uncomfortable as we sense a change in the way the church feels, I think will better be understood by seeing these larger contexts, both the larger LDS context, the context of LDS history, and the larger worldwide context. It may not make us feel any better, but at least I think we can see that what we're feeling is not necessarily just a conspiracy of some mean old men in Salt Lake City that want to make our lives miserable. That may be happening too. But that is not the, I think, the fundamental way to understand what's happening to us. Against that background, the Decalogue, which Nadine has given to us, I think is very valuable. She denies that it's a Decalogue, but I think it's a good Decalogue, and I really commend it to you. I was especially pleased with the reference in I think it was her ninth commandment about the importance of promoting a parsimonious idea of LDS doctrine. We have got to get the doctrine of the church understood as made up of a relatively small core of fundamental ideals. Only then, by the way, with a parsimonious core, can we have any hope of exporting this. I mean, we will certainly be able to export the notion of continuous revelation and a new book of Scripture, the Book of Mormon, vicarious work for the dead, and all those wonderful, authentic Mormon ideas. We will not be able to export corporate management practices necessarily. We will not be able to export right-wing politics. We will not be able to export Protestant fundamentalism as part of the Mormon message. And one of the things that makes me optimistic about the future is that I think the attempts to export this is going to will bring home to our leaders more clearly than anything else the folly of this kind of mix or syncretism, which is what it is, a syncretism or corruption of authentic Mormonism with all of these things that have been borrowed from the outside. The attempt to export that syncretic product is not going to work. It might go on the Wasatch Front, but it isn't going to go in Nigeria and a lot of other places. And so it will be that the resistance to all of that as we attempt to export Mormonism, I think will bring home in a way that we are unable to in North America the folly of this more expanded and synthetic product of Mormonism that we feel around us. I hope my optimism will be justified. Even more, I hope I will live to see that optimism vindicated, but I really think it's there, and there's a certain irony to that, in somewhat the same way as it was our black church members in Brazil who saved us from the albatross of our racial policies in 78, so I think it will be the faithful Latter-day Saints in various exotic places outside North America that will eventually save us from this fundamentalism that we are all experiencing and suffering from at this point. One other observation that has always meant a lot to me, when Nadine spoke about canard of contention that's always thrown back if you bring up a contrary idea. Quite by accident, from reading the scriptures, which I do now and then, I came across a wonderful discovery. The passage in question in the Book of Mormon does not say that contention is of the devil. It says the spirit of contention is of the devil. Let's emphasize that when we talk about contention. I take that to be an attitude of picking fights. Now, people, I think, are rightly condemned for that attitude. It doesn't belong in the church. It doesn't belong in families. It really doesn't belong anywhere. But that's a very different thing from charging that contrary ideas are in and of themselves contentious or diabolical. And so I think that's the only additional suggestion I would make to the wonderful list that Nadine has given us. There isn't much time left, and I know that all of you have things that you'd like to say. And so, though, of course, I could go on for 50 minutes, that's my scheduled time, I'll spare all of you that and thank you for your attention, and we'll talk later.
I hope that some of you will have comments, and maybe you could tell us about your successes in speaking up. I'm sure many of you have done it. I also wanted to tell you one other thing. I thought some of you might wonder where I got some of my ideas about the Old Testament, and I put together a little reading list of sources that I think are useful for coming up with some of these ideas and for having a fresh way to look at things. I've got about 30 copies. It's probably not enough to go around, but if any of you are interested, it's up here on the desk, and you'd be welcome to pick them up afterwards. If you have questions, you can ask me, and I'll repeat the question into the mic for the tape. If you have comments, I'd appreciate it if you would come up here and speak into the mic so that it will be on tape. Lavina. Okay, the question is that the examples that I gave were all from the Old Testament, and what do I do when the topic is a social issue like abortion or obedience or the roles of women? I do kind of the same thing that I did. Let me try to think of an example. I'm sure if I think about it, I can come up with one. It's kind of hard right on the spot. I speak a lot about women and about women's roles. Okay, let me give you an example from when we did New Testament several years ago. We were talking about the epistles of Paul and where he talks about women being in subjection to their husbands. One of the things I pointed out was that in those chapters where Paul talks about women being in subjection or submission to their husbands, it also talks about slaves being in submission to their masters. And what I point out is that the things that Paul says are very parallel. And so Paul is not interested in those, in within his context, in upsetting the existing social order. So he tries to make the social order that's existing at that time into a better and more humane place. So he says, wives, be in submission to your husbands. Husbands, love your wives. Slaves, be in submission to your masters. Masters, treat your slaves well. Remember that you, too, are a servant of God. And so he tries to mitigate the harshness of the circumstance without upsetting the social order that he's not in a position to change. Maybe he didn't even want to change. And then I point out that he also said that there is no more Jew nor Greek, no more bond nor free, no more male nor female, for we are all one in Christ Jesus. And I contrast that with the daily prayer of a male Jew of that time and Orthodox Jews to this day. Praise be God, King of the universe, who has not made me a Gentile. Praise be God, King of the universe, who has not made me a slave. Praise be God, King of the universe, who has not made me a woman. And I point out that in this statement that Paul makes, it's a very broadening, liberating statement for women, freeing them from this very oppressive worldview that the Jews had at that time. So that's an example. Back in the back.
Yeah, my question is very interesting in terms of liberalism, but it seems to me that the mainstream church, not the pastor, but maintains liberalism. I think creates real problems for the Mormon and the Great Christ if they don't. I'd like to hear your comments on that.
Okay, that's a good question. The question is, I have, in my talk, said some things sort of rejecting scriptural literalism, but it seems to create some real problems for the Book of Mormon and the Pearl of Great Price if the church doesn't uphold spiritual literalism, or scriptural literalism, excuse me. And so what do we do about that problem? Well, I think that we have to still continue to view the scriptures as being created by human beings who were not perfect. They were not dictated directly from God. They were the writings of people speaking under the inspiration of the Holy Spirit, perhaps, usually maybe, and sometimes not. And I think that historically, Mormons have not taken the scriptures that literally. There has long been an acknowledgement that the scriptures are imperfect and that they are the products of men and that they contain errors and that they're incomplete. So I agree that there is this trend toward trying to see them as inerrant, and I also agree with your suggestion that not taking them literally poses some problems for our modern day scriptures. But I think that we are going to have to face the fact that there are some problems with our modern day scriptures, and we need to find a way to look at them in a way that isn't literal, because I don't think it's going to hold up over the long haul. And so I think it's better if we start trying to see them in a more symbolic way, as stories that enlighten our faith and our understanding, but not necessarily as historic events. And I don't know if you read the article a while back by Ed Framage in Sunstone about the Book of Mormon and his kind of loss of faith in the Book of Mormon, but he points out in there that this problem is not unique to Mormons. It's a problem for the broader Christian community looking at scriptures. As scholars, historians, form critics have come up with very plausible theories about how the scriptures came to be. So the Pentateuch wasn't written by Moses. And the scriptures were compiled in ways that supported a particular scriptural agenda. And I think that as we come to see all scriptures in this larger context, it's going to be easier for us to deal with the problems that are unique to Mormon scriptures. Lou? If you want to make a suggestion, come up.
I do not teach the gospel doctrine class. I'm quite sure they wouldn't let me do it on a regular basis. But I'm there. I sent out this. I mimeographed this. I photostatted it. And the teacher is very happy to pass out anything of this. This is the sources showing your Yahwist, the oldest source, the Elohist. You should know the differences, because this will be very important. One of my tactics, since I'm not the teacher, I bring things like the fact that there are two separate, irreconcilable versions of story after story after story in the Old Testament. And I had the opportunity, when the teacher went on out on vacation for a week, of teaching it. And so it happened that I chose, got to Genesis 3. I went back to Genesis 2:4, picked up the second story, the older story of creation, and followed very carefully along, and I used six Bibles. I used three Christian, three Jewish. Christians was the King James, which I followed carefully. I have the American translation, and I used the Luther translation, since I read German as well. And that's also an official church Bible, by the way. And I taught, and I'm sure the class has never had Genesis taught to them in that fashion before. I have brought such things as the history of the language, showing how it was an oral language for years, and how finally they borrowed the Phoenician characters and transliterated their language. And I tried to get people into knowing what the meaning of transliteration and translation was. This, of course, is a sentence that says approved of God or something like that, has a determinative prefix, it means it's a name, and transliterated, it's Shargina, but that's Sargon, that's the name of Sargon. And this was the transliteration of the word Israel. This is our oldest mention of the word Israel. And I try to in the two stories of the Ark, for example, and tomorrow, if all goes well, there will be two stories of the two separate irreconcilable Ten Commandments and the absolutely impossible stories on how to get Moses up and down that mountain and who got to see whom at what time. So, I mean, I think you just by... I don't like the fraudulent pretense of studying the Old Testament. This is just a juvenile catechism that we got from Salt Lake. We're supposed to be studying it. And so this is what I keep hammering home and what the teacher also does. He's glad to get these materials. Tomorrow I'm going to give out a map of Egypt showing where Goshen was, and which, of course, explodes the Cecil B. DeMille crossing the Red Sea type of story. And gives a better insight into what was happening. So I think that I'm getting away with it, at least I think so far, to just insist that we study it and that you do the studying yourself. Be familiar with these things. Know that there are three separate stories as to who killed Goliath, not just one. And so on. And you bring these up. You've got your King James Bible. Open it up and read it. And say, well, where does this fit in? Ask questions. You know, you don't have to say, I don't believe it. And here's my bibliography about, we happen to have in our library some, oh, I guess 100 books on the Old Testament, New Testament, so I come pretty well prepared on it. That's enough. But
thank you. I would love to be in your Sunday school class. Any other comments? Chris?
Maybe I'm missing something, because I like everything you said. And every time I come here, I hear all these horror stories. In my own world, I don't experience them. Whenever I talk, I say I'm going to preach a little bit of false doctrine today.
Do you want to come up here and say this?
No,
okay. All right. Okay.
I don't know anybody in my world that's trying to have more babies than anybody else. Yeah. I don't know anybody that's trying to be...
It's a generational thing.
Who's trying to obey the bishop more? We don't have anybody that wants to obey the bishop at all. I mean,
the comment, for the benefit of the tape, is that in this Good Brother's ward, they don't have the same kind of problems that we're talking about. They don't have anybody trying to obey the bishop more than someone else. In fact, the bishop has trouble having anyone obey him at all. I realize that, yeah. But I'm sure that it makes a lot of difference where you live. And I won't say that we have horror stories in my ward. We certainly have a lot of people, though, who have very fundamentalist, literalistic views of the scriptures and of the idea of obedience to authority. And that is clearly the party line of the church right now. And so while there are other people who will say something else, the people who feel most empowered to speak in church are the people who echo the party line. And if you do anything else, you're posing some kind of a challenge. And so really the point of my paper is that we need to say things that legitimize not always speaking the party line. When the party line is limiting to people and doesn't help them and doesn't...